All right, so today is session two, class three, and we're going to be looking at mitzvah number 42 to 46, the laws and treatment of Hebrew bondservants and maidservants. So, I hate to say that I don't know that much about this subject. I wish I knew more.
And I've never had a Hebrew servant.
Right, or been one. Pardon?
There are a lot of rules about it.
Yes, there are a lot of rules about it, so we'll see some of them. So let's just start with a general introduction. There are two types of servants. There's the Hebrew servants and the Kanani servants, which means any kind of foreign bond servant. It's often translated as slave. It's inappropriately translated as slave and inappropriately translated as servant. It's kind of an in-between because they are a servant. So I don't know exactly what bond servant means. That might be the right way to translate it, actually. Because it's not slave. People aren't sold as property. That you were selling the time of the person. So you were selling the time of the person for a specific period of time. But you're not actually selling the human being. It's the time of the human being. So it's not slave like we have. I mean, like there still is slavery today. It's not that kind of slavery. But it's not servant either, where they just get to pick, oh, I feel like working today, I don't feel like working today. Or that's the kind of servant anyway we have in this country. So it might be more like earlier servants.
Which were sort of more like slaves.
Right, except for they got paid something. So it's not that. You see somebody out there who should be in here.
Yeah, but not anybody.
Oh, it's Allison.
Oh, great,
she
come.
Oh, good.
Has she been coming?
No, she hasn't. Yes. Hello, welcome.
All right.
Well, good time.
We're happy to
it's
see
so
you.
Good to see you.
Good, so we're first learning. You know that there's two classes, right?
Huh?
Do you know that there's two classes?
Yeah. Now,
okay.
You know what? Has this ever been announced?
I don't know.
In the announcements?
No, not in the announcements. No, it hasn't.
And I don't remember it ever being announced.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, it probably hasn't.
I have to talk to Esther at the Malavamak, and I'm like,
it wasn't
said,
our show.
We're going to relocate it because
sure
nobody
it
from Ish comes. And I said, well, right, nobody knows about it.
Oh, good. Well, come.
But you're not here a lot. So
right.
That's, yeah.
Right. Right.
I'm here now.
That's good.
I would
love to know about
it
if you're not.
You're not on my email list?
Evidently not.
I have a class email list. I just email it when I teach classes.
Oh.
So. Of that. It's a Jewish experience class, really, a Lishma class, which is part of Jewish experience. And so this has been going on for many years, but we just moved down to here to see if other people would want to come.
Not
anyway,
anything.
Right.
Okay.
So what we're starting with Sefer Chinuch, so today we're looking at the laws of bond servants and maid servants. So we're talking about the translation of what that is. So this first class is about mitzvahs. The second class is bridging the gap. Right. I think I have this paper, which won't help you that much this time. Right, you're right. Right. Right, okay, you listen. Okay, so we're just talking about what that means, what a bondservant is. So it's a good question, and so we'll figure it out as we go along. So it's not a slave and it's not a servant.
Well, how come Hebrew bondservants are treated differently than...
Now, isn't that a good question?
Because people are people, and
right.
I know that...
Right.
You know, there are distinctions, but in terms
right.
of how one should treat a person who
right.
is
so they both
there,
have to, right. They both have to be treated compassionately, and I don't know enough to answer the question properly this
okay.
time. I hope I will learn enough to answer the question properly when we deal with the other servants.
Okay.
Because this time we're just dealing with the Hebrew servants.
Okay.
Maybe we can find out when we find out how they become a servant.
Well, so
I don't know if we're gonna find
there was something interesting in this today that I didn't actually realize, and I raised a question for me, which I don't have an answer to, but we'll look at still. But it is interesting just to read some of the things it says. Okay, so we definitely have a concept of Eved Ivri. In general, the Eved Ivri, the Hebrew servant, is becomes a servant, becomes the whatever you want to call them. Their time becomes sold when they either steal or incur a debt that they can't pay back. So this is
so
the way that they can
way.
Pay back. This is the major way.
The major way.
Right.
So it's a punishment.
In a way it is. It's a restitution. Let's
well,
not call it a punishment.
A servant to the person from whom they stole?
I think that they could, or it could be somebody else as long as that person gets the money.
Oh, so the person to whom they are bonded, shall we
mm-hmm.
say, becomes obligated to.
They have to pay up front, as far as I'm aware.
So, like,
they pay up front. Yes.
The services.
They purchase, right, exactly. They purchase the services for 7 years.
Well, I knew the 7 year part, right. So, but I didn't, okay.
Or until the Jubilee year, if the Jubilee year happens within that time period.
7 years. So, either they become indentured, shall we say. Maybe it's like an indentured. Because that was sort of.
Maybe, yeah, that might be more
you know,
what it's
so
like.
So they're indentured to the person from whom they stole.
Mm-hmm.
Or.
To whom they owe.
Or right. Mm-hmm. Or to another person who sort of stands in their stead. And
right.
Purchases and then pays the.
Right, that's just the only way they have to get the money. They
right.
have nothing they can sell. No property.
Other than themselves.
No real estate. Right, no even clothing to sell. Mm-hmm. They have a debt that's bigger than what they own. Then they can sell their time for 6 years, 7 years. And then they're released at the end of that time. If during that time they somehow manage to save up enough money to pay for a year or two of their service, let's say you buy somebody for 70 dinar, right? That's 10 a year. Mm-hmm. And then the person is working for 3 years but manages to save up 40. Then after 3 years, they can buy their freedom. They can pay you back. And it specifically says in here, you're not allowed to say, and particularly with a girl servant, which is trickier, which we'll see, you're not allowed to say, but I see now that you're well trained, or now that you've grown a little bit, your time is worth more to me
right.
than 40 dinar.
The deal.
I don't want to sell it for that. And, so you're not allowed to say that. You have to let them go. And you're not allowed to say, well, I paid 70 for you, and now 3 years later you're giving me back 40. I could have had that 40 invested in something else and made interest. I want you to pay me the interest, right?
How in the world would they ever be able to get money, though, if they...
A deal is a deal.
Well, but how would they ever be able
A deal is not a deal is the point, because the deal is a deal means that you could... A deal is a deal. You could just tell them, no, a deal is a deal. You have to stay. I bought you for 7 years. Your time is mine for 7 years. You don't get to buy it back.
Like the amount. The value can't fluctuate based on aging and value of the individual
right.
and their time.
Right, but it does. Yeah.
How would they ever get money? Because typically, people in this scenario aren't paid.
So they may be paid. Or it's possible, because they're not slaves, they may have extra time.
Or a relative could save up money.
Or a relative could save up money.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. You
know? Right, right. So it does seem possible that that because they're not a slave, so not all their time is owned, you do have to treat them appropriately. So it's interesting. So the first mitzvah here, number 42, is just to carry out the law of the Hebrew slave as it is written in the Sedra. For it is stated, when you buy a Hebrew servant. So this just means dealing with him the way a servant is supposed to be dealt with. So it doesn't mean you have to buy one. But it's interesting that this is pretty vague as a mitzvah. If this is one of the 613 mitzvahs, that the law is to deal with the servant the way they're supposed to be dealt with. Right? That's the law. So it's not that specific. But it does talk about where it is. So that law first appears in Exodus 21:2, and then the details are written in. So here's something to think about. The details are written out in tractate Kedushin. Right? So why would the details be written in tractate Kedushin? It's about Kedusha. How we treat somebody as a servant has to do with Kedusha. So it has to do with Kedusha holiness, but also if you think about what the meaning of Kedusha means, is also set aside. Like if something is Kadosh or Hekdesh, it's set aside for use in the Beit HaMikdash. Or when you get married, the man says, Hare at mikudeshetli, you are sanctified unto me. So in that sense, it makes sense. Your time is kadosh to me, right? I've purchased it, so it belongs to me, set aside for my use. So it makes sense, but it also makes sense that it has to do with holiness, that that's the way you're supposed to treat people. And let's just see in page 199, this first paragraph there, at the root of this precept lies the reason that God wished his people Israel, whom he chose, to be a holy people, filled and adorned with every good and noble quality. For as a result, blessing will be bestowed upon them. And kindness and mercy are among the most worthy qualities in the world. For this reason, we were adjured to have mercy on someone who is under our ownership. and to treat him with kindness, as it is written in the Sedra, and as we know further by the oral tradition.
So this does sound like ownership, though. That's interesting.
Right. So it is an ownership of the person, but it's not total. It's not a slave.
Right.
Right? It's because it is a limited.
Something in between.
That's what I'm saying. It is something in between. We don't have a good word for this, really. It is something in between, because they do belong to them during that time, but not totally. You're not permitted to rape, for instance. They don't belong to you that much.
Well, in this concept of slavery that we had, for example, in this country, and is in, as you said, is present in other places even now at this time, are people really, I mean, I know slaves were raped, obviously.
Right. But are they really allowed to?
That's what I was going to say. I mean, are they really, I mean, it seemed, I always felt, and I don't know why,
it was
that it
ugly
was sort of
even.
Outside
right.
the parent. I mean, you know, you had to give them enough food, whatever that meant. You had to give them shelter, whatever, again, whatever that meant. You know, it seemed like there were certain criteria that that applied even to a slave.
I don't know if they did. I mean, I'm just not sure. I know there were certain people who were nice slave owners.
Sure.
And certain ones who are not. But was there a code?
Yes.
I don't think there was a...
Well,
forget the Torah. There certainly was the Bible. Anybody could have read the Bible. But not that. I'm saying I don't believe, I'm not sure, and I have done, it used to be a particular interest of mine, but as a kid, I did a lot of reading about slavery. From the reading that I've done in the past, I don't believe there was a set of laws or even a code of ethics.
That's what I'm sort of more thinking.
Right, a code of ethics. Like in the streets in the Bronx, I just heard an interesting thing on NPR last night. There was a code of ethics about fighting. You could not pick on somebody who wasn't your size. You were only allowed to fight people your size, and different blocks had different codes about wrestling, not wrestling, could you, like what could be employed in a street fight, what couldn't, what was fair and what wasn't.
Right.
There was a code of ethics that was enforced by the boys on the street.
Right.
So was there a code of ethics in dealing with slaves in the South? I don't believe there was. So I believe that there were... I think so. I think there were wiser owners, kinder owners, and stupider and meaner. So a not kind but wise owner would provide his slaves with proper housing and food because it was good business sense.
Not
correct.
Because he was ethically
right.
or morally bound to
right.
do so.
Right,
right. Right, exactly.
Right, yeah. So that would be a wise owner.
Less food, they're right. able to work harder.
Right, that would be a wise owner who was not kind. You could be wise and kind. You could just be kind. You could just be wise.
Right, right.
Or you could be mean and
right.
stupid. Right? So, but I don't, as far as I understand, there was not a code of ethics. So that while being raped certainly wasn't pleasant, obviously, but I don't think it was considered, and it probably was, it was considered de rigueur, whether or not it was considered okay. But I don't know if people were looked down upon for doing it. It was probably, I think it was considered,
like that was part,
that
of,
was part of it. Yeah, you bought her, she's yours. Do with
that
her what you want.
You bred your next generation of slaves, too.
Yeah.
Well, they, you know.
Well, they did breed
They
did breed slaves,
yeah.
and they did sell children away
right.
from parents. I mean,
oh, totally.
They belonged to the owner.
Doesn't sound too ethical.
No, no. So there was not a code at all. But I don't believe that the South either was outside of the usual way slaves are treated on
well,
the planet.
Even now, I mean,
even now, I'm saying slaves thing. Today are treated that way. Yeah. You know, and there is, as everybody knows, slavery still in this country. I mean, the way they take. They bring over Chinese immigrants, take away their passports, tell them they'll call the police. They don't know that there's justice or rule of law in this country, so they can keep them enslaved, working in sweatshops and basements in Manhattan, you know, sleeping on the factory floor. They have no clue that they could walk outside, find a cop, and a cop would help them, because they don't come from a culture of that.
Well, only tell them that you're here illegally, very possibly, too, and the police will not help you.
Yeah, they'll help you from your slave owner, but they'll help you go back on a plane.
Right, which is sort of where they were trying to get away from.
Right, but even though they're trying to get away from it, some would go home rather than be slaves.
Right, I'm sure.
Some wouldn't. Some would stay. But some would. So.
Sex slavery.
Oh, yeah.
Huge. All over the world.
Yeah, all over the world. Yeah.
Worldwide one, right?
Yeah. Right, so it's not. So this is, if you think about it then, in terms of...
It's relevant.
Yeah, it's relevant today, and it's relevant in terms of a code. So it's not relevant today in that this only applies, if we look at the, let's see, one, two, third indentation on the page, This precept applies to a man, but not to a woman. For a woman may not buy a Hebrew servant. And this is only when the Israelites dwell in their land, for the traditional explanation is given that the law of the Hebrew servant is enforced only at the time when the law of the Jubilee year is observed. Excuse me, and is made quite explicit that the law of the Jubilee is observed only in the land. So it's not technically relevant today, because since we are not living in the land with the law of Jubilee being observed, we can't keep this. We don't have slaves. I don't know if we will in the future or not, but we don't certainly now. So on the one hand, it's not relevant now, but it still is relevant now. That's why it's recorded, is because there is something that we learn from this. So we do learn the concept of compassion, and that is here throughout. So in this last paragraph here, it's interesting to look at the punishment, because the punishment is the same as the reward for education, just the opposite. You know, so what do you get? What's your reward if you're a good student? You get smart. Right? That's your reward. You don't get chocolate, right? But you do become transformed. You're more capable. You're hopefully a healthier, stronger person if you become educated. So here, if someone violated it and did not treat a servant as it is written concerning him, he would thus disobey a positive precept and teach himself to be cruel, and would practically attest about himself that he is not a Jew. For they are compassionate sons of compassionate fathers. Looking in the Hebrew, it doesn't say sons and fathers. It says, ki hem rachmanim b'nei rachmanim. So Jews are rachmanim b'nei rachmanim. So it's from the word rachmanis, rachman, merciful, compassionate. Right? We are, that's one of our defining characteristics as a Jew, is we're compassionate. Not just we're compassionate, but we come from a long line of compassion. As a people, we are compassionate. Somebody who doesn't display compassion, you're allowed to wonder if they're actually Jewish. So it's interesting, Rabbi Abitan, of blessed memory, can I borrow your pen? He said, I should have written this bigger. Here. Okay, so this is what a man is, a mensch. In Hebrew, is a gever, right? So gever, he says, stands for Gomel Chasadim, Baishan Rahman. Somebody who does acts of kindness, who's reticent, who's merciful and compassionate. That is the definition of a man in Jewish. That's what a real man means. So Gever means strong. Gibor is a strong person. But it says in Pirkei Avos, Ezehu Gibor HaKoveshet Yitzro. Who is the strong person? The one who conquers their own Yetzer. Right, so we definitely have a different definition of what strength is. So there's an internal strength that defines the Jew. And in fact, that's the battle between Jews and Amalek. This last week's parsha, we had the battle of Amalek attacking the Jews, but that's the lifelong battle. And the reason why we have to wipe out the memory of Amalek is because that's the core, the central battle of the entire world. Is the battle between Amalek and the Jews. So that battle, I learned from Rav Hirsch, is the battle of what is strength. Is strength military, or is strength conceptual? So Amalek represents the force in the world that says strength is in military strength. It's in arms, whether it's physical, your own arms, or in military arms, but strength is in arms. And the Jewish concept is strength is in the soul and in the brain. It's intellect and spirit. And so America, who has taken up the banner of many Jewish principles and spreading them to the world, is straddling that. We can't really figure out 100%. I'd say we're 45 military arms and 55 conceptual. But because we're a little bit more, because we do believe in the power of education. This is the first country in the world that had free universal education and mandatory, made it mandatory because they understood how important education was. But we do understand about spreading education in the world, and that's why we have freedom of speech and freedom of the press and freedom of assembly is all about the importance of ideas and the transference of ideas and how ideas, the power of ideas and spreading ideas is the power that will ultimately, in a way, take over the world. And Jewish ideas will, in the end, take over the world, and not through military strength. But that is one reason why we care so much about freedom of access to information, freedom of the internet, right, in China. And that's why the Chinese are petrified to have freedom of access. because they understand that ideas are stronger than the sword in the end. And they will undermine the Chinese authority. And the strength of arms is not strong enough to keep down an educated people.
Yeah, the internet is changing the world.
Yeah, right. Right, it is. So, so that's the whole battle between the two. And it really comes down to what is the definition of a real person? What's the definition of strength? And how do we as Jews define ourselves? So if we meet a Jew who's lacking 100% in any of these, kindness, reticence, or compassion, then we're allowed to question their lineage. Are they actually Jewish? So... Right.
Key then.
Yeah. So we do wonder about certain people. It's true. And you see today, I mean, in Israel, there are Jews of questionable descent, many of whom came from Russia. And you see you just see things sometimes in the Jewish police or army that you just can't believe a Jew would ever do. You know, where they take a settler wife with her baby away from the settlement to get her to talk about her husband and separate the baby from the mother, allow the baby to cry in a separate room so the mother will talk against her husband. Like, this is Jewish? These are Jews doing it to Jews. And you just have to wonder, like, who are you doing this? You're not a Jew. You may say you are, but that's so not Jewish.
Well, there are slaves in Israel. I mean, there are,
yes.
You know, I mean, it's...
That was brought by the Russians, too.
Yeah.
It did not exist before the Russians. Mm. There is slavery in Israel. And, yeah.
It's terrible.
There's prostitutes,
but,
and there's working, there's
the people that, you know,
foreign,
like,
workers.
Houses,
yeah.
You know, like as nannies or servants.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. A lot, mostly, mm-hmm. Yeah. From the, right.
It came with the Russians?
Yeah.
Well, that concept.
The slavery came with the Russians. So the outside help was there before. And I think the Filipinos came earlier. I don't know if the Filipinos are a lot. They were before the Russians. But I don't think they were slaves. They were outside help. And they came as a servant class to Israel to help, especially with the elderly. It's considered like it's a job description today. People say, you know, I need a Filipino. They're not talking about, you know, the nationality. They're talking about what Filipinos do. Right, that's what it is. Yeah, that's what they do. You know about the couple who went to their 50th, the man's having his 50th high school reunion. And he goes by himself, you know, and comes back. And his wife says, well, how was it? He says, it was great. I just don't remember so many Filipinos in my class. So, yeah. So in Israel, it is kind of ubiquitous at this point. But there is, unfortunately, slavery also. There's sexual trafficking and slavery. And that came with the Russians. The organized crime, the drugs, the prostitution was a Russian gift to Israel, unfortunately. But if you behave in that way, so that's what it says in this last paragraph, people can want, you're announcing to the world, you're not Jewish. Because Jews are Rachmanim b'nei Rachmanim. We are compassionate people, the children of compassionate people. Okay, so next one, 43, marital designation of the Hebrew maidservant. So the mitzvah is to designate a Hebrew maidservant for betrothal. That is to say, that the very Israelite who purchases a Hebrew maidservant should take her for a wife, or give her to his son for a wife, as it is stated. If she does not please her master who has designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. And our sages of blessed memory noted that here you have a hint that there is a mitzvah of designating her for betrothal. Moreover, they of blessed memory said explicitly, the mitzvah of designation for betrothal takes precedence over its preferable to the precept of redemption. So the precept of redemption, mitzvah number 44, that we talked about a little bit, is that if she saves up enough money, she can redeem herself early.
Unless you decide she's going to be your wife.
Well, so that's what this is. So you're saying that as like, I can't believe it. But it's actually seen in a different way, because we do have this concept of Rachmanim b'nei Rachmanim, that the concept here is that she should be elevated. So, and how is she elevated? Right, how is she elevated? She is so poor. She comes from a family that's so desperately poor that her father sells her into servitude, which is what I'm saying. I don't totally get it. And he can actually sell her a few different times, apparently, but only if he has nothing, including clothing, to make any kind of money. So what does that mean, though? So what is this supposed to be? So this is really a way, and I'm pretty sure I heard this from Tzipora Heller, this is actually a way of elevating a girl out of poverty. So she's not allowed to, she can't be married against her consent. That's not permissible. But he's not allowed, he should be purchasing her with an eye to marry her. So that money goes to the father, but then the daughter is raised out of poverty. She has to be taken as a wife, not as a servant, not as a concubine, as a wife. And when she's married, then she's taken out of servitude altogether. So she's supposed to be elevated, but she might be too young. She might be 6 when she's first sold. So he should look at her as a potential wife for me or for my son. And so not only is she taken, not only does the father get the money at the time, but she's actually raised in a home where she'll be a better wife to the son. Because if you're raised in the ghetto or raised in poverty, but then you're marrying into a middle class or an upper class family, a family that has enough money to purchase you, it won't be a good match in the end. She won't know, and there won't be the cultural background to be able to make such a marriage happen. She'll still be too low if she comes in, if she's marrying up, if she comes in as an adult and is marrying up, it'll be too much of a bridge. Too much of a gap to bridge. All right, so here the idea is she should be sold younger, which benefits the family, but benefits her in acculturating her to the family's norms.
Is that different than sort of a dowry or a bride price?
Right. So and yet it is. I'm not exactly sure of all that stuff, but it's not a dowry because.
I mean, I understand.
A dowry usually, doesn't a dowry, so a bride price is the opposite. The dowry goes to
the groom's family,
and the bride price goes to the bride's family.
Okay, so a bride price.
So, because she's not valuable. She's valuable as a virgin. It's interesting, I was just unfortunately reading Nicholas Kristof in the Times.
She must have some value or she wouldn't be purchased.
Right, so she has value, right, so she might be pretty. So she might be attractive.
But she has value.
She has some value, right. And she is going to grow into somebody who can do more at 6, 7, 8, 9, because she can be purchased at that young. So she can do stuff around the house.
So it's a question of what the purchase is for, really. Where the bride price, for example, is clearly for the marriage concept, whereas this is sort of something that would grow into that.
Right. It is a little bit more.
Is she one of many wives?
I would say yes.
Probably not.
Well,
that is not our ideal in Judaism. Mm-hmm. It's not our ideal. Our ideal is monogamous relationships. So that's our ideal. That's why it says he should leave his father and his mother and cleave to his wife, not wives.
But in the Bible, they had many wives.
They had. There were examples of polygamy, but it was never, ever recommended. And the examples that we see were only because of particular reasons for fertility. Kings are different because of alliances.
Right.
You would marry not, you're not marrying for love and you're not marrying for, you're marrying to consolidate territory. You are marrying to consolidate territory, which was permitted. As a concept. I mean, it certainly was a reason then, but it's not the concept of marriage. It is a concept of a political way to consolidate land and also for conversion, interestingly. So King Solomon, for instance, was looked quite down upon by scripture because he married 1,000. So, and that's, kings are specifically not allowed to marry more than about 18. Is considered tops. And 18 is crazy. You can't have a relationship with 18 either. That's for political alliance. But Shlomo, with his wisdom, thought he could outsmart the Torah. That's why he's condemned for doing it, because he actually thought he was smarter than the mitzvahs until the end when he realized nobody's smarter than the Torah. But he did think, well, you know, I'm so smart, I could do this. I will do this to consolidate territory, and I'll also do this to spread Judaism. Because as I make each one of these wives Jewish, their children will be Jewish, but it will influence their families and the territory that they come from. It'll help consolidate or strengthen the bonds of Judaism across the land. Of course, the opposite happened, and the wives influenced him negatively instead. And also, conversion standards were lowered, because if you think about it, he's one guy. He ruled for 40 years, so he probably married most of them within the first 10, 15 years, right, 20 years of his rulership. So in 10, 15, 20 years, to convert 1,000 women, that's a lot of conversion going on. So he had to create a special conversion court for them. So the bar was lowered to convert his wives. So it wasn't a proper conversion process altogether for most of them. Anyway, but polygamy is not recommended in Judaism at all. And there's nothing like the Mormon concept of plural marriage being a good thing.
So this would be somebody conceivably who purchased a maidservant or whatever after his wife had died, or, in more common circumstances.
Possible, right, possible. right, because if he doesn't want to marry her, so then to a son, and if not to a son, then he has to let her free. She's not property that he can just pass around. The idea is she's raised in his home, and then as her personality emerges and as they see how the chemistry works, she either becomes a wife or she becomes free. But she's not just a piece of property that can be passed on to somebody else. She can't be sold. That's one of the...
When she marries, she loses that servant?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. And she can redeem herself. So she can get out of it. Right. So look at Mitzvah 45. that whoever purchases a Hebrew maidservant is not to sell her to any other man ever. As it is stated, he shall have no power to sell her to a foreign people, since he has dealt faithlessly with her. That means, as Unklus translates it, to another man. But in order to convey the matter in a more emphatic way, thank you, emphatic way, this expression was used. In other words, to the poor child, if he sells her to another man a second time, it seems to her, it seems as if he has sold her to a foreign people. At the root of the precept lies the reason that God wished to make us meritorious, and he commanded us to behave with the quality of compassion which is beloved before him. The laws of the precept are written above with the mitzvah of designation for marriage. So that she is not a piece of property that can just be sold like property. Bringing her into your home, although there's a monetary transaction that precedes it, is for the purpose of marrying her, bringing her into your family. But in a way, there's kind of like a probationary or a training period where you could decide. But let's say you decide you're not interested, then she has to be redeemed. She can't just sell her to somebody else. She's not.
I thought she was just set free.
She can be set. She can either be redeemed or set free at the right time. All right. So here, number 44, the redemption of a Hebrew maidservant. So this mitzvah is to redeem a Hebrew maidservant, as it is stated. Then he shall let her be redeemed. This is a positive precept, i.e., that the master who purchased her should assist her in her redemption and give her a chance to return to her father's home. As our sages of blessed memory said, he reduces her redemption price and she goes free. That is to say, if he acquired her for 60 dinars for a period of 6 years, and she worked 3 years and saved up 30 dinars, that he should take them and send her away. And he should not demand of her to complete her years of servitude, no matter what. Nor should he say, my money remained useless with her. Let her add on something as my profit if she wishes to go free. For this is nothing but the heart's evil. And since the Israelites, the Jews, are royal princes, compassionate sons of compassionate fathers, it is fitting for them to deal kindly with human beings, even with those who have been their servants, even if for but one day. At the root of the precept lies what we have written about designation for betrothal. Its details are equally to be found there in the tractate Kedushin. So,
if she's defiled during this period of time.
What defiled?
As in,
they're not allowed to have sex with her until they marry her.
All right. She's not... Okay, let's
say... That's off limits.
Let's say the son does.
That's a rape. And then that would go under the laws of rape.
Okay.
Then he would be required to marry her.
Because certainly she would lose great value to her society at that point.
Right. So in that case... So there are laws of rape.
Okay.
So in the laws of rape, which is... It's interesting because you wonder why. And in the laws of rape, he's required to marry her. If she doesn't want to marry him, she doesn't have to. But he is bound.
Okay.
Once he's done that, he's bound to marry her.
Okay.
So
that makes sense.
Yeah, so, and
that's... Either way...
That's different, yeah.
The individuals in the household might have to make her a wife.
Right.
Should they defile her.
Right, and so, which they're not permitted to do. Jews are rachmanim b'nei rachmanim. So that should be protected. And that's why there's laws of how you treat her. You know, where she would sleep and what it would be like. So, and it does say late in here, just in the laws of the Hebrew bond servant, so whether it's maid or man, that they have to be treated the same as you. They're not allowed to, you're not allowed to eat fancy meats and they have pottage. You're not allowed to drink old wine and they have new wine. You're not allowed to sleep on soft cloth and they on straw. They have to eat, drink, and sleep like you do. So that too, they're not like a slave. Whatever level you're on, they have to be on. So you may have to reduce your level to be able to afford to put them on the same level. But you're not allowed to eat, drink, or sleep on a different level than them. It has to be the same.
Does that apply to a male servant as well?
That's a male servant. That applies to a male servant. And
I thought we were talking about maid servants.
Both. So we were talking about maid servants in different mitzvahs, but for both, that applies. Yes.
So any kind of servant, has theoretically.
Has to be treated like you treat yourself.
When does that really?
Whatever level you're on. It seems that way, right? It seems that way. It
seems dubious to me.
It seems dubious because we're thinking about the South.
Well, not only that. Yeah. Right. I was going to say, right. I don't think I am necessarily thinking just of the South. I mean, clearly that. But it just seems to me that in general, if people feel that they have, many people, not everyone, some measure of control, ownership, or whatever, even if it is over only. I mean, think about think about how people, I was just talking to someone the other day about how some people who were on a cruise, somebody was on a cruise and they were talking about how, by and large, the people on the cruise treated the crew.
I've been on a cruise.
You know, I mean, it's, and they were
despicably.
You know, and it was, and they were just, and this woman said, this woman said to somebody, well, you're so nice to them. Them meaning
the crew. The servants.
And it was like, she's like,
right.
I've seen that. So it's not human nature for sure.
That's,
but
I guess
that's
right.
God is
so that's exactly, and that's, this is why God is giving us the commandments,
They may not follow them. You're right. It's dubious whether or not they'll.
But these are the rules.
These are the rules. And so let's just back up for a second. Why is there servitude altogether? Why don't we have debtor's prison? No, there are debtor prisons in other societies where you just were thrown into jail and your friends and family had to raise the money to pay your debts. Why not that? Right? So the concept of this, as far as I understand, the concept of male bondsmen altogether, whether it's debt or theft, so debt from theft, is rehabilitation. We don't have jail.
With rachamim.
It's rehabilitation with rachamim. So what you're doing is you're taking somebody out of their family. So just imagine somebody today who steals, and of course it's not only ghetto, but just imagine taking somebody out of the ghetto and putting them with a middle class family for 7 years to work off their debt. But the idea is to absorb the values and the lifestyle and the work ethic and the education and the vocabulary and the what it's like to be in that home. Because you're not in a cottage. You're not behind them. You're not in the slaves' quarters. You're treated like a member of the family.
Wow.
So, so it's rehabilitative for the person, but also the family is understanding that they're part of a social pact here. Their job is to rehabilitate. That's why they're doing it. They're doing it for the help also. But in a way, it's an adoption. And so we do have actually a tradition of really majesty within the Jewish people. Think about all the work that we've done with immigrants. Think about the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. So that's HIAS, which worked for Jews and resettling Jews. And how many, even in Colorado, there's stories of, you know, people's grandmothers who would wait at the train for the immigrants to come in and then bring them to their new place, teach them how to shop and how to cook in America, and that people, that other Jews met them and cared for them and integrated them. And when the Jewish immigration was over, so we helped other immigrants. And we still today have a tradition, certainly wealthier Jewish women, but women who don't have to work for money, volunteer. We have a very strong tradition of volunteering. where women work really hard for the benefit of others. So this is, in a way, doing that. It's saying, okay, we will make a space in our lives. Yes, we will get some benefit. They'll help with the dishes and the plowing and the, but what we're doing is taking this person under our wing to guide them to a better life. Which is why at the end of the 7 years, no, it's not. Which was why at the end of the 7 years, a servant might say, I don't want to go free. Sure. Keep me. I love living here. Don't, oh, sure. I mean, don't make me go home. But it's not just the food and the lodging. It's, I mean, the right. Whole, you know, it's the whole relationship.
You just put the whole thing in perspective.
Like, right? It's totally different.
You could
right?
see now why somebody would.
Yeah. Somebody might say, I want to stay here. Which is why you would then pierce their ear under the mezuzah and say, you have a choice to leave and to use your ear to listen to the commandments of God, but you're choosing a lower level to be a servant to listen to the commandments of a human within the commandments of God, but that the human will be your direct boss and God will be in charge of that human who will be in charge of you. And so we pierce your ear to say you've chosen to listen to another.
Now, if a person chooses to stay after the end of the 7 years, can they then leave at any time?
I don't know how that works. I would imagine that...
I mean, are they having sort of said, okay, I'm staying?
Sure sounds like a commitment, doesn't
it? That's what I mean, I hadn't thought about it before, right. But it seems to me once you sort of have a physical... is it like, okay, now you're set, you're here?
I would imagine since we're Rachmanim, B'nai Rachmanim, and they've paid their debt...
They theoretically should be able to leave.
They should be able to leave at any time.
Why would you go through the process of piercing?
Well, because you've because you're in a different, you are in a different status.
Well, and I would also
a servant is exempt, like women are exempt from positive command, positive time bound commandments. So the servant who's told go milk the cows, but Zman Kriyat Shema is almost over and they haven't yet davened, can go milk the cows. They don't say to their their master,
sorry,
I didn't daven yet. I need to, you know, finish Kriyat Shema by Zman Kriyat Shema. They don't get to say that. They're, in a way, like a woman who doesn't have that obligation, so their time is much more flexible, which means they reduce the amount of mitzvahs that they're obligated to do. So they reduce those stronger pathways for connection without actually being a woman who has her other strengths of pathways for connection. Which is why she doesn't need as many mitzvahs. So a man who allows himself to stay a servant permanently reduces his status.
Well, it could also show that the master has, in fact, fulfilled the commandment as well.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a sign in general to
of the relationship,
the community
right.
as well,
right.
you know, that he did.
Yeah, the choice was, the
right.
person made the choice.
Right, in other words, that I didn't force this person to remain
right.
as my servant
right.
beyond the time.
Right.
But you just said they permanently reduce their status.
Well, so they reduce. So
they,
then, so then I don't know if they can leave.
Mind.
Right.
Yeah.
So can they exit?
Right.
Yeah. And I just don't know. I don't know the law of that. Yeah.
Surely they can.
But not as servants. Meaning maybe they can leave the servitude. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, and then that would be their tshuva. Mm-hmm. But they can choose to stay in it if they want to stay in that relationship. And there are people who choose that. You know, I mean, we saw that.
Maybe better than any of the other options available.
Right,
to them.
Right. And they may appreciate the relationship, both. You know, because it's not, it wasn't a relationship of slave. It was a relationship of rehabilitation, hopefully.
Well,
so
if they choose to stay, they're still considered a servant.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right, they are still a servant. But we see that in the South, and we also see that in England. I don't remember the books I read about that, but in the South, you see slaves who chose to stay slaves even after the emancipation because they appreciated the relationship and possibly because it was better, but also because they appreciated the relationship. They wanted to stay serving. They loved their master. They were willing to stay in servitude. And that I would imagine that would be in cases where the master was a wise and kind. They treated them like a mensch, and they did work for them. But you also see that in some of the older books about England when a wealthy family had servants who were lifelong servants because there were servant classes, right? And then the wealthy family lost their money. But the servants would stay on for free because they were servants. They served that family. Why would they ever leave? That was their life. You know, that so if that family was going to be poor, then they'd be poor with them. But at least they'd have ironed clothes.
Yeah. See, the prison system in America, oftentimes people serve long terms. When they're freed, they can't cope.
Right.
Right.
Right. It's a little bit different, but that is the coping skills that, you know, we do. We are releasing people in foolish ways. Mm-hmm. Yeah, giving them too much when they're in and giving them not enough to transition to go out so that they can't equal on the outside what they had on the inside. And the loneliness. I heard a piece about the loneliness of the newly released prisoner.
Well, you can think about that. They're isolated unless they have a strong family, which if they've been in prison for a long time...
Right, the family and friend network is gone, and the friend network that they had for the last however long is gone. So they're released into nothing.
To do the right thing and to function without all that
contact. Right, very, very difficult. It is very difficult. That's what I'm saying. We don't give them proper transitioning. You know, there really should be a halfway system.
Good, we can afford that.
Yeah.
there are some,
but not. I mean,
but it's not for everybody.
I mean, I knew somebody who was released from prison, and you know, is released with clothes, and off you go. And the guy was on meds in prison, and was released without even like a month's supply in his pocket.
So
no antidepressant, no diabetes medication. So immediately the guy spirals into depression and into diabetic problems, and like really, give the guy a month's worth of meds. And a prescription for next month on his way out the door so he can function. How do you let a guy go without antidepressants? I mean, it's the stupidest thing.
We do that a lot.
Yeah, we do that a lot. Right, and that's what brings that kind of recidivism. Because what are you supposed to do? And you're not even in control of your thoughts at that point.
And you read examples of people who intentionally go out and do something to get arrested.
The rate of recidivism is
huge. It's huge, right, right. But you see, with something like that, like obviously, what are you supposed to do? So, yeah.
Where in Jewish history do we have a record of people having servants?
Only in biblical times.
Only in biblical
times. Yeah. So, well, but we do have some stories, which I haven't read exact stories, but anecdotal evidence that I've heard about, of Jews in the South, slave holders in the South, who treated their slaves according to these laws, which is why we do have some born, not converted, black Jews in this country who converted then. So there are a few blacks who converted because their masters treated them according to these precepts. And so they became Jewish. So I've just heard one. I mean, I think I did meet one. So I know there's a few that exist. Who knows what those conversions were like, or if they just adopted Judaism, you know, if they actually went to the mikvah.
If that was the case, I mean, it's been going on now for, you know, 100 years, so.
Right. Right. So, and there are a few black congregations. Some took on, you know, just made up their own stuff.
How would that be? If you had somebody, let's say, in that time, who had a conversion or whatever, let's just say they took on the...
Mm-hmm.
And then go through generations, and succeeding generations really did everything. Thought they were Jewish, did everything. I mean, what is the deal?
Right.
I mean, does that mean...
Mean that they're not Jewish?
Yeah.
We don't consider them Jewish, because we don't know. But I would think if we would see somebody who was Shomer Shabbos, who had Shomer Shabbos parents, we would consider them Jewish.
To make an assumption. Did you just say?
Somebody who is Shomer Shabbos with Shomer Shabbos parents, who has a tradition that they're Jewish, we would consider them Jewish. Somebody who thinks that they're Jewish
and acts Jewish.
A black person or a Hispanic person who has a tradition that they are Jewish and is Shomer Shabbos themselves and has Shomer Shabbos parents. You would consider them Jewish. You would assume that they're Jewish. If they have Shomer Shabbos parents, I think halachically you consider them Jewish. If they come from Shomer Shabbos parents and they are Shomer Shabbos, that means that there is a real tradition there of them being Jewish. But if you're just like part of a congregation where your parents said you were and your grand. So you probably would require conversion.
Shomer Shabbos? What about Shomer
Kashrut? No, Shomer Shabbos means the package. Yeah, it does.
relationship.
It does. Very few people are Shomer Shabbos and not Shomer Kashrus. I mean, you
well, there's a lot of people that are Shomer Shabbos that eat out.
You know, before
yes,
get
yes.
Their,
are they fully Shomer Shabbos would be a good question.
Yeah, you know, they're kosher in their house. They eat out. They don't eat out. They don't eat meat.
Right.
So the way I did it is I got a letter from my rabbi.
Right. Well, they have a kosher practice.
Okay, so I don't see how Shomer Shabbos necessarily.
Well, that's
today it is different. You're right. Shomer Shabbos, it is. You could be Shomer Shabbos and not keep fully kosher.
That's
true. Right, right. My birthday is coming up, and my husband asked me what I want for my birthday. I said I want a healthy husband, which means he has to exercise and lose weight. So he said, how about healthy style? Yeah, it's funny guy. All right, let's go back to this. Okay, what you have? Okay, there's the clock. Okay, good. So we have one more mitzvah to look at here. So this is some discussion of maidservant, manservant, and the differences. So the last mitzvah to look at in this group is mitzvah 46. Which is not to withhold from one's wife her rightful due. So you might think this is different, unless you just read the first paragraph, that whoever purchases a Hebrew maidservant and accepts her in designation for marriage is not to leave her short of her rightful she'er, ksut, and ona, the three things that we promise in the ketubah, that a man promises a woman in the ketubah. The meaning of she'er is food. Ksut has its plain meaning covering, clothing. And ona means conjugal intimacy. Now, in this negative precept, all Israelite daughters are equally included, that none of these things is to be diminished for them. It is a matter that we learn by kal vachomer, reasoning from the lesser to the greater. So does everybody know what kal vachomer is? So it's a legal principle. And you probably know it in Latin, right? How do you pronounce that?
A priori?
Say it again.
A fortiori.
So, but we more often refer to it in Hebrew, kal v'chomer. So what it means is we learn from the simple, the stringent. So we learn from the fact that a maidservant wife cannot be denied any of these things. If she can't, how much more so a non-maid servant wife can't be denied these things? Right, so that's a kal v'chomer. You learn from this that is included. So this mitzvah is about a maid servant, not to anybody who purchases a Hebrew maid servant and accepts her as a wife cannot deny her she'er, ksut, or ona. So how much more so somebody who doesn't purchase a wife, somebody who marries somebody in the regular way, cannot deny these three things to his wife. So because this is discussing the maidservant, there is a kal v'chomer that it goes to all women. So no woman can be denied these things. And that's why it's written, he shall deal with her after the manner of daughters. So she has to treat her like all other women. So the sages said in the Midrash Mechilta that this comes to teach us about another matter, and that is that we learn from this about the daughters of free women. So we learn the same thing. And the last paragraph, let's see. Oh, well, let's read this, these two paragraphs. Among the laws of the precept, there is what our sages of blessed memory said. If a person makes a condition with his wife, I marry you on condition that you have no food, clothing, or conjugal rights due from me. We learn what the law is for him. Then there is that which they said, a woman can rise in status with her husband, but not go down. Therefore, her food and clothing due her are reckoned according to his level. Meaning he has to give her what he can afford, but he can never give her less.
No less than he has.
Right. Right. There is too the subject of the difference in the various times of conjugal due, according to the arduousness of the husband's vocation. So it's interesting. So we've all heard this before, that this exists. So here is one place where it's written. So it's interesting that it talks about the arduousness of the husband. So however hard his labor is, that correlates with how often he's required to offer her conjugal intimacy. So in keeping what our sages of blessed memory said, that the conjugal frequency due from a sailor is twice a year. A camel driver once a month, a Torah scholar once a week, and it is fitting that this be Friday night. These and its further details are clarified in the order of Nashim in the Talmud, where they are scattered. So there's not one place, but scattered all over the place, but in the order of women in the Talmud. This precept is in regard for a free daughter. This precept in regard to a free daughter is in force in every place and in every time for men. If a person transgresses it and leaves his wife short of any of these three deliberately of his free will, that line, I'll check it later. I have a daughter who might need my attention. Because he so intends, if he denies her of it of his free will, because he so intends to make her suffer, he violates a negative precept. He is as one who violates a warning of the king, but no whipping of lashes is given for it, since it involves no act.
So it's a failure to act is what it is.
It's a failure to act. So he's not punished for the failure to act, although he's condemned for it. And he'll pay for it. You know, so in many of these mitzvahs we see, there is no specific punishment. You don't get whipped and you don't get fined and you don't get, you know, you don't get killed, certainly. Those are the punishments. Whipping and death are basically it. But you don't get punished here, but the punishment is you are diminished as a human being. And you'll pay for that later on. You know, you lessen yourself. You lessen your status. You become less of a person if you don't do this.
The world to come is
not. Yeah. You actually pay for it in this world, too. It's interesting to think about. I'll just give you an example. I met with somebody recently whose husband just went through a terrible tragedy. Terrible. And she's not somebody who's worked on herself specifically, religiously, in her life. Somebody who kept kosher, but left it there and considered herself pretty religious because she kept kosher. But now that she's faced at 60-ish with this horrible tragedy, and I went to go visit with her in the hospital because she's a friend of somebody that I know, she has almost no resources to deal with this tragedy internally. You know, she is diminished as a human being because of the choices that she's made. She hasn't chosen herself into a place of strength and forward striding. She doesn't have what to turn to internally or externally. She doesn't know where to go in the library to find solace. She doesn't know where to go in her heart to find solace. She doesn't have a prayer practice that works for her to find solace. Or like, she doesn't have it. So she suffers in this world, not just the next world. Because now she can't, she doesn't have what she needs to deal with it. So, yes. Yes. But not fast enough.
No,
I mean, it's hard.
The suffering's going to be there.
That's right. Not fast enough. Not in this acute phase of pain. This will likely be a long, drawn-out process. But during this acute phase, this several-month phase of dealing with the initial phases of the tragedy, she does not have the resources.
So she's a wreck.
Yeah. Yeah, she doesn't know how to pull herself together. So she's trying. She's trying, but yeah. But she has to develop. She has a long time to go to develop it. So, yeah, one does grow through keeping these things, and one does diminish oneself through not exercising these things.
Someday she'll look back and maybe she'll see that it was for the good.
Maybe, right. So it's interesting. I just read something in Ein Yaakov as I was preparing for a class I taught yesterday, that says that unlike the physical, in God's world for Torah learning, it's the opposite. So in the physical world, something that's full can hold no more, and something that's empty can be filled. It's just the opposite when it comes to learning Torah. Somebody who's empty of Torah cannot be filled with it, and somebody who's full of Torah can always hold more.
Isn't that
interesting? Yeah. That's very nice. So we'll end on that note for this week.